Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron grits. Welcome to Gridiron Grits Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Grits Publishing and Broadcasting Network in conjunction with Slick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Grits Magazine. And I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Grits Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Grits is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongritsmagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for the largest selection of football memorabilia and cards on the web, msbsportscards.com. And also by BST Auctions. Check out their website for the upcoming fall auction at bstauctions.com. It is at this time I would like to introduce my co-host. He is a senior contributing writer. Gridiron Grits Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails across the country from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the show.
Captain, how are you, sir?
I'm very good. We have a hot, humid June day here in Connecticut, one of the few that we get. Very interesting.
I'm embracing my new senior contributing writer title at Gridiron Grits. I had some cards made that I'm going to be handing out at the National.
I've had several people comment on it, and they said they were also impressed that you are now a senior contributing writer. You've written a lot for the magazine since I took over. So there's a lot of stuff you've contributed to. Also, you've contributed with helping other people with their articles also. So, you know, you've done a lot with the magazine, and I appreciate it. I thank you for that. That's
important. I love it. It's a labor of love.
Keeping the word of football, cards, and memorabilia in history alive in the world today. Gridiron Grits Magazine.
Without a doubt.
As we were talking about before the show started, briefly, it's kind of a slow time for football cards and memorabilia and the magazine itself, and basically the buying the mail and emails go down this time. Time for me to get a little caught up with everything. And we just started working, actually this week we were on vacation for a couple of weeks, came back home, and we started working on the National issue. National being in Chicago, which is technically Rosemont, Illinois, to that location again. And I guess next year it's back in Cleveland, which will be interesting. And so anyways, we're getting started on that. We're going to have a lot of good information in the new magazine, interesting articles and the like. And again, once I found out where our table is, I will be broadcasting that to check us out at the National. I'll be there set up Wednesday through Saturday. And we're coming and flying in on Tuesday. And, yes, Brenda will be coming with me this year. She'll be making an appearance at the National. Chuck.
Perfect.
Let's talk about the 35 National Trickle Set. We've talked about it briefly in the past. Let's look at it again.
Digging in on the Trickle. It's so funny because tongue-in-cheek, you know, I've mentioned I collect uncut sheets. My collecting habits have drifted to that. And whenever people ask what my white whale is, it's the 35 Trickle uncut sheet, second series preferably. But, I mean,
wow.
because some friends of mine have joked around, probably about 5-6 years ago, I started asking people if they knew how to knew what the uncut sheet of a 48 leaf looked like. I'd been collecting miscut leaves for probably 5-6 years. You'd find a miscut card and you could see what the another adjacent card was if it had writing on it. And it was always weird when people would have grossly miscut cards on eBay or something, and I'd email them and hey, do you have a can you send me a scan of the back, just to see how grossly miscut it was. And after a while, I had a good idea of how the leaf sheet looked. And then I started a topic on one of our chat boards, and before long, there was a Mike with Mike Thomas, forgetting who he's with, but he put together what the uncut sheet looked like. And lo and behold, an uncut sheet of 48 leaf in about 4 pieces came up on eBay, and I bought it. I pulled the trigger on it immediately. So one of my pride and joys is this 48 leaf uncut sheet that's in about 4 pieces. And it's obviously 2 uncut sheets that have been, two different sheets, because there's some overlap of about 4 cards on them.
All right. Is that the full set that you bought for the 48 leaf in the sheet?
It is.
You have every card?
Yep, it's both.
Okay.
Yep, both series. I'm missing 1 card off of it. But like I said, it's 2 sheets that have overlap.
Okay.
About 3 cards, but yeah. So, somebody was joking around the other day. It's like, you should start a thread asking people how to put together the Chickle set, the sheet, because last time you did that, the leaf sheet appeared. So I figured it'd be a good chance to talk about, the Chickle set and the uncut sheet, because no one has ever seen an uncut sheet. No one knows how this was assembled.
Right.
Certain it's in 2 series. There's 36 cards in the set. So fairly certain they were cut on, 2 sheets of 18. Which is odd for the,
right.
for how they manufacture it. But if you look at some of its sister sets, the non-sports sister sets, they were printed on 2 separate sheets of 18 as well. So you can see in the population.
I got a question for you. I know you're pretty heavy into uncut sheets, and give our audience just a rough description of your uncut sheet collection, because it is phenomenal, to say the least. So,
we're moving, and I keep most of my uncut sheets in the tubes they show up in, and then what I'll do is I'll consolidate four or five uncut sheets down to one roll. We're moving, so I had to move that collection, and I decided it was easier to store it somewhere now than that. So at my office, I built a up on top of the offices, I laid down some MDF board, which is a nice smooth board, put a plastic, thing over it. And then I unrolled these sheets and put them up there, and then put another piece of MDF over the top and try and lay them flat, because they are a bear to store. And I had my son help me take them to the office, and we had this little thing where we'd unroll them on a desk and take a picture of them. And then I'd climb the ladder and go up there and put them up there.
Wow.
I made it about halfway through. I estimate I have between 425 and 500 uncut sheets, ranging from leaf to Bowman, Philadelphia. I have the partial uncut sheet from 65 Tops that I talked about last episode that has Joe Namath on the top.
I remember that one. Yeah.
57 Tops uncut sheet that I included in an article on the 57 set probably about a year ago. And that one I have framed. It sits in my office. It's one of my favorites. But,
so you probably I'm gonna go out on a limb and say you probably have the largest football card and memorabilia collection in Oregon right now with everything you have. And I never realized the sheer volume of sheets that you had. I knew you had quite a few. I never realized it was that many. That's truly amazing. I go back to the late 80s. I was at a show, and a dealer had about a half a dozen strips of 1960 Fleer football cards and 10-card strips. And I forgot what I paid for it. I can look it back. It wasn't that much. He wanted to get rid of them because they were starting to get nasty on the sides, because there was no way really to could store them or anything. And I held on to them over the years. I basically sold them over the years at the same time. Very surprised at what I got on a lot of them. They were, a lot of collectors really like them because they're an unusual piece. But to have that many uncut sheets is just amazing, truly amazing. And you would definitely have the granddaddy of them all if he did find that 35 Chicle sheet. And I have no record of it anywhere. Over the years, I've never seen anything even resemble, you know, a 2 or 3 carat cut of the sheet itself. So that's truly amazing.
A friend of mine about 3 months ago said, if you weren't the co-host of Gridiron Greats, you would make a hell of a guest.
Very true.
Which is kind of funny.
The other thing about the 35 Chicle, which I understand yet I don't understand, maybe you could educate our audience a little more about it. There's, in theory, 12 high numbers. So if there are two sheets of 18 and 18, are there actual double prints on that second sheet? And would you have any idea of what those double prints are?
Yeah, I think there is. And you can literally draw a line. That's a great question. You can literally draw a line where the cards start to get difficult. Oddly enough, the number two card, the Bo Melinda, is very difficult to find. No idea why. Maybe it's a corner. Maybe, you know, you just don't know. Dutch Clark is tough to find. He's a Hall of Famer. That's a rookie card. It's pretty high population. So perhaps it's just because he's popular. You know, you could go back to, you know. But literally you can draw a line, and it's somewhere. It starts to happen around Clark Hinkle, the number 24 card, and Dale Burnett, number 25 card. So in all actuality, out of the 36, two-thirds of it are pretty high pop, 1 through 24. So you'd almost think that there is a double print of those, you know, two thirds, and then it gets a little difficult. Dale Burnett card number 25 is one of the hardest to find. The Bolt Hosey card number 27 is probably one of the rarest and hardest cards to find in the set. You know, you think 35 Chicle, you immediately think of Bronco Nagurski. But in all actuality, Bolt Hosey, Bernie Masterson, those are the bear cards to get in the set. I think there's like 4 PSA 8 Bolt Hoseys. I've only seen one, you know, since I've been collecting, and it was a very ugly PSA 8. So they're out there, but you know, that's a tough card. Yeah.
You know, it's funny when I was collecting that set, and I tried on and off 3 different occasions. I tried collecting, and then I sold them off. I did have the Masterson's card the last time. It was raw, and it wasn't in bad shape. I would grade it like BG. None of my cards were graded. But you're right, the Tosse card, I've never really seen. I mean, I've seen maybe online a few times, but at all the shows I've been to over the years, and even back when you could pick up Chicles pretty reasonable, I never saw, number one, I never really saw any high numbers, and his card I really never saw at all. Really never saw at all. No, unless it was an auction or whatever type of thing.
Yeah. Several years ago, I was putting this set together in PSA 8, which was no easy task. And, you know, the first, you know, 1 through 24 were pretty easy. And, you know, then you started getting, you know, Burnett's, Ernie Cadell, McMurdo, Koska. These were hard cards in PSA 8. And it took me a long time. I finally found a PSA 7 Nagurski. And then at one point, I upgraded that PSA 7 to a PSA 8 Nagurski, which was the cornerstone of my collection for quite a few years. There were two cards that I couldn't nail, and that was the Tosi. I didn't even have a Tosi, and the Bernie Masterson, I had that in PSA 7. And I was very, very happy with my PSA 7. And probably about 4 years ago, I decided to, you know, I don't need this in PSA 8. And I started selling cards off and then collecting them in the grade I wanted it. You know, I just, I'm kind of drinking the Kool-Aid of Bob Swick, you know, where I'm like, I don't need a label. I don't need a flip to tell me what to collect. I started selling off some of these ugly PSA 8s and picking up a really, really nice PSA 6 or 7. And I'm a much happier collector.
Well, I'll tell you, anybody who knows me knows my dislike for greeted stuff, and I don't want to spend the entire show talking about it. I could spend the rest of the afternoon till 5 o'clock tonight talking about it. But anyways, you know, a card has to be appealing to you. I'm going to be the first one to admit a lot of my cards in my collection were the beaters of the beaters, but they got good stories behind them, and I will keep them forever. And I go back to my Chickle set. I said to myself, if I can put a set together in GVG condition, I'm perfectly happy with it. I tell you, 90% of my cards were GVG. I had a handful of cards that were X or maybe near mint, which I was shocked. Uh-huh. The third time I sold them off, how much I got for them. I was just shocked about the whole thing. But again, I don't play the grade game. And as anybody knows, the only cards I got graded in the collection are the 1894 Mayos. And the only reason why I got them graded is because I like the way they look in those black SGC holders. As far as the grade numbers are concerned, grade numbers are ridiculous on that set. I got a 40 that should be a 10. I got a 10 that should be a 40. I mean, it's ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. So I would agree with what you're saying. You know, be more savvy on what you're collecting. You know, people always say buy the best card that you can afford. Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Also, buy the most pleasant looking card you can afford. Also, it does not have to be graded. You know, I really believe that. You know, and we've gotten off on this on the 48 leaf trim cards and all that, and we talked about that. You know, to a great team. In the past, but again, for the 35 Chickle set, to me, it's almost an impossible set to collect in a very high grade. They're just not out there. They're just not out there.
Well, and I think the card doctors have figured out how to. You know, the Chickle set. You know, the dimensions of the Chickle set are a little wanky. You know, just like the 48 leaf set is. So I mean, they're the two of the most prone sets to card doctors are the Chickle and the leaf set. I'm sure card doctors have got a hold of other sets, but these two sets are the one you have to be wary of card doctors slipping one by the goalie.
Right.
So don't buy the flip, educate yourself. I mean, and I found that with my Leaf set too, I was starting to get frustrated with, really crappy trimmed PSA 8s, PSA 7 slipping through. So I sold that off and now most of my collection is PSA 6 and 7, but fat bordered PSA 6 and 7. And this set's the same. I mean, it's very interesting. Right. So, I mean, I have to get the plug in. I mean, if any of our listeners out there know of or have any idea where I can find an uncut 35 Chickle, you can email me at faotw@hotmail.com, and I will immediately respond to you. 35 Chickle uncut sheets. That's my plug. Pretty please.
And if,
it'll look amazing hanging on my wall.
And you can contact us through the magazine, too. We'll be more than happy. Or you can call us, too. We'll be more than happy to broker this incredible deal that could be possibly 10 minutes here. We get a 35.
Mike Blaisdell.
Yeah, not to me.
Mike
to
Blaisdell
me, it would,
probably
to me, it would be, to me, it would just be incredible for you to pull down that sheet. That'd be an amazing find, to say the least. So that's something to be looking forward to say the least. And again, it also whets my appetite. Should for the fourth time round, I start putting together the set again. I don't know. I have three pickups in my collection, as I tell everybody. The 52 Bowman Large, which I still have probably half the set sitting downstairs, not doing anything. I still got the Mayos that I'm pretty stagnant on. I haven't been winning many bids on them. And the 35 Chickle. Those are the three last sets to say I actually have the mainstream run of football cards. The Mayos one day I will finish. I'm still hoping locally here to find them at a flea market. In fact, when I emailed you earlier, I said to you I got to run out. There was a couple of estate sales locally. I ran in and ran out. I didn't find anything as far as sports stuff was concerned. But I didn't realize how close they were to the house here. So I said, let me go see what I could find. If I could find, the Dunlop card.
No kidding.
Three of them. In a mixed box or whatever for $5.
That's the beauty of the East Coast, Bob, there's so much history. People were buying stuff and hoarding in attics before Portland was a pimple. I mean, Portland's been around a long time, but an old house here in Portland is like 1910, 1920. And that's an old house. So you're not going to find many T206 cards, you know, jammed in an attic of a house that was built in, you know, 1915. So,
well, we got houses here in Wallingford from the 16 and 1700s. So, and I've been to several tax sales there, and they're truly amazing what you see. Not just sports stuff, but other items. Well, our guest is ready, and I'd like to introduce him now. Our guest tonight was born in Louisiana.
He's been ready since 6 a.m.
and raised in Mobile, Alabama. Scotty attended the United States Military Academy and graduated in 2002. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Engineers Division. He's been stationed in Texas, Missouri, Hawaii, New York, Italy, and currently is stationed in Los Angeles with the United States Army Corps of Engineers. He's had deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. He's earned his master's degree from Columbia University in New York City in 2011 in organizational psychology, married with 3 young children. I'd like to welcome to our show Mr. Scotty Oten. Scotty, welcome to the show.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's really an honor to be on the show. I've been listening for a while, so it's great to finally be here.
Now, I'd like to remind our listening audience, Scotty had an incredible article in the last issue of Veteran Greats on Army and Navy programs and memorabilia items and history of the game. And I got to say this, I do have a handful of Army-Navy programs in my collection. I've always, if I ever see them at a show, I normally pick them up. I know quite a few people here on the East Coast and still collect them. And I got to say this, your first half of your article was incredible, and I know a lot of readers are waiting for your second half for the national issue, so we're looking forward to it. But it was an excellent article, so informative. The images that you had of the programs were phenomenal also. How did you get started in collecting Army-Navy football memorabilia and programs?
It really started probably, when I was a young child and just the collecting bug. My father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, you know, they were all collectors. And not so much sports, but my family's all collect, you know, guns, coins, stamps. And my great-grandfather and grandfather were the person who the kids and the families always brought oddball items. So anytime I went to their house, it was like going to a museum. And and they taught me pretty early on that, you know, it's not collecting the hoard, it's collecting for the preservation of the history. And so I was always getting a history lesson every time I visit them.
That just gave me goosebumps, Scotty. I like that. That is such a great outlook on it, preservation. That literally just gave me goosebumps. Love it.
So when I was fortunate to attend West Point, and from the first day you arrive at West Point, you just get pounded in your head the importance of the Army-Navy game, and beat Navy is on every wall and at every turn. And that game has such a special meaning to cadets. And as you go to those games, you realize, I mean, it's more than football. I mean, you've got, you know, just the stadium full of people. They're all cheering. It's a love of game. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance. And you start to learn as a cadet very early on how just the nation and the world use that game as a chance to kind of break away. And, you know, it's not about vying for NFL contracts or anything. It's just about coming together, you know, on the battlefield or the football field. Our military cadets and members from around the world just watch that game and get excited about it. So that really kind of started it for me. And I think what really kicked it off, I was on an assignment in Texas, and I just kind of got to thinking about, you know, the old Army Navy programs. I'd had the ones from when I was a cadet. I kept those in, they're that late 90s, early 2000s football program. It's just pictures, you know, you got a couple pictures of players. So I was kind of wondering about the earlier ones, and I started looking them up, and I found the pictures of the 20s and 30s, and it's just this beautiful Art Deco covers, very cartoony, and it's got just a great, you know, that old flapper looking feel to it. And the first one I was fortunate enough to buy, I bought it on eBay. Probably the first time I used eBay, it was a 1922 Army Navy program, and it was a West Point cadet and an Annapolis cadet, and they were vying for the attention of this girl on the cover, and it just had this really beautiful look to it, and I was I remember winning it at a what I considered a very fair price. I was fortunate, you know, to have that something at that time, you know, a little over 80 years old. And when I received it, I started looking through it and just reading the history of the game and history from that time. I think I was hooked. And I moved to West Point. I was fortunate to be stationed at West Point while I went to grad school. We lived on post and I traveled to school. And so West Point, what a lot of people may or may not know, is actually it's the oldest military museum in the nation, you know, as these general officers would travel back from their, you know, tours from around the world, they would just give their stuff to West Point. So it's got a lot of great military history displayed and in storage. But as I went through the archives, I found very little that dealt with the Army Navy game. And so I kind of drew back to that childhood experience that, you know, you've got the greatest museum in the nation, and they're terrible at preserving their own kind of sports history. And so I kind of felt a calling.
I've heard that in the past, that they haven't done a bang up job as far as preserving their sports memorabilia and the like. I'm surprised about that. I really am.
Yeah, it was really disappointing. I mean, you know, it was aside from a couple of scrapbooks here or there that, you know, that would have some pieces in it. They just didn't really. And so I felt called to kind of, you know, preserve that aspect of history. So I really went on a tear to start pulling in programs throughout the years. And I was fortunate to find a partner in crime that felt the same way. And he kind of picked up the program and I started going after the tickets. And then that was really where I found my bug, was in the tickets. I just loved the difference of the tickets. And
your ticket collection is pretty amazing, Scotty. You have full ticket stubs, you know, in your collection, I mean, which are incredibly hard to find. I mean, you have 110-year-old full ticket stubs that are just amazing. I'm ex-Navy. I'm not sure if you knew that from previous shows. So I took the liberty of looking at a couple of the stats of the Army-Navy game here. Obviously, Navy won the first one in 1890, 24-0, trouncing on a hapless Army team. And in the 100 games, Navy has won 73, Army 27. That's just my math. I could be off by about 20 or 30. A game wasn't played in 1917 or 18. Obviously, it looks like for World War One. They played through World War II, 41 through 45, which I found interesting. But there was no game in 1928, 1929. Why not 28 and 29? What was significant about that?
That's World War One really, you know, put a pause. The academic department felt that football would distract from, you know, the drive and focus of the cadets supporting the war effort. But interestingly enough, you know, at that mid-20s time frame, both Army and Navy football really started getting a lot of national attention. I mean, that was college football was the premier entertainment of that time.
Yeah.
And the Army-Navy game was drawing 100,000 plus spectators every year. I mean, it was really a huge draw. And what has happened, though, was there was a change in eligibility of playing requirements. And so the Navy adopted what was at the time a 3-year eligibility. So a freshman couldn't play. He could dress up but couldn't play, but then he was eligible to play his sophomore, junior, and senior year, whereas Army didn't have the eligibility requirement. They still had to sit out their freshman year, but if they came from another school where they had played college football, they were still allowed to play their 3 full years. And it really caused a lot of dissension between Army and Navy, and they just couldn't come to an agreement. Navy definitively said, we refuse to play anyone that doesn't have the same eligibility requirements as us. And that the Army said, no, we're not going to bend. We believe, you know, Army has a big thing about treating all cadets equally. And so, you know, why would I allow one cadet to play 3 years, but not another? And they couldn't come to an agreement. They came to an impasse, and it was actually
interesting.
The president to the academies right after the stock market crash, in 1929, at the end of 1929, beginning of 1930, and said, hey, I would really appreciate if you guys would play an exhibition game. It doesn't have to count as your regular season. And it'll be a charity game. And I want all the proceeds to go to the unemployment fund. And they both agreed. They felt that, you know, that was for the greater cause of the nation. When the president asks you to do something, you kind of, you definitely need to listen. And the game was a sellout. Yeah, the game was a sellout. I mean, it raised a phenomenal amount of money for the unemployment fund, and it kind of re-sparked that rivalry. And so they did it one more year in 31 as a exhibition, and then from that point forward, the game was back on.
I noticed most of these were at Franklin Field earlier on. Man, talk about history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it.
And so there's a great piece in the article about how that all kind of got put into place with Philadelphia and Franklin Field. I think it's a fascinating point of the history of it.
So I'm looking at your collection. How do you narrow that down? What would you say are like your top five items? I mean, in your collection, they don't have to be ticket stubs. And oftentimes they're not. I mean, I collect. You know, I'm known for kind of Steve Largent stuff, but you know, the top five things in my collection, almost none of them have to do with Largent. So yeah, what are your favorite things?
I would probably say my I couldn't rank order them, but you know, that you talked earlier, I have an 1899 full ticket stub. It's the very first ticket to the neutral site. You know, you're looking at 118 year old ticket that its sole purpose in life was to be torn in half.
Yeah.
And it's full. And I mean, you got a game that was, the demand for tickets was 3 to 4 times the amount of tickets printed. So just the fact that a full ticket, and it's a, you know, a PSA 6, which, you know, just gives it the idea of the quality there. It's unbelievably hard to find. So that's definitely one of my highlights.
Looks like it's a reserved seat to William Biddle Jr. Have you ever tried to find out who that gentleman was and why he missed the game?
I did, you know, and it's unfortunate. I mean, you know, Google and Facebook didn't exist in 1899, but I did. I tried to look him up, and you know, I would have loved to see his story, you know, what happened. And that's kind of the unique thing, is that because the tickets were so in demand, and to, you know, their first attempt to try and limit what, you know, we later know as scalping, and they wrote the name on every single ticket to know who it was going to. I'd say, you know, I think my next one is I picked up a couple years back a West Point yearbook from 1894. And this is one of those, it's about a foot thick because it's just full of cabinet cards. Got 50 patch cabinet cards in it of all the cadets, of all the faculty, of sites around West Point, of all the sports teams. So that's definitely an incredible piece.
Is that featured in your article coming up?
It is not. No, I focus mostly on the Army Navy side of it.
Okay.
You know, we could probably do a, but it's a beautiful, it's got a very, it's leather bound. It's got the big metal clasp on it. I mean, it's just very regal looking, for the time. One of the recent one I picked up that I just love, it's a 1950, poster, a railroad poster that's advertising the Army Navy game. You know, they the amount of people that had to travel to the stadium for that, for those times, and it was a really big plug for the Philadelphia Railroads and all the others. And so I have a really, you know, beautiful orange graphics, and you know, that early 50s kind of focus on marketing and reaching. I love it. It's colorful. It's got the Army Navy game. It's got football players on it. It's kind of all the stuff we love as collectors.
Were those printed like every year for like a short period of time? I vaguely remember reading something about those types of posters and their collectability. Do you know anything about them, Scotty?
Not as much as I know others do. I know they were printed because at least this one, it has the date on it, you know, and it's a special event. I've seen some of the broadsides for them. They're a little smaller. They would display them in the stores just to advertise their tickets, you know, the train tickets or something along those lines. But this one, I mean, I could see that this one is in one of the rail cars, you know, as a display or even in the station. It's beautiful. The, you know, the other one, I think probably I have a 1944 Army Notre Dame program, and it's signed on the cover by Earl Blake. and Earl Blake is the iconic football coach that really put Army football on the map in the 40s and throughout the 50s. And he played for Army in the early 20s. Was there, when MacArthur was the superintendent. Him and MacArthur became very good friends, and they call him the Colonel, and I mean he just ran a tight ship, and Army picked up two national championships under him. They've had three Heisman
wow.
Trophy winners while he was at the Realm. You know, Pete Dawkins, Glenn Davis, Doc Blanchard, really iconic names, all kind of learned their way.
Yeah.
Vince Lombardi was one of his assistant coaches, and
yep.
you can kind of say he put Vince kind of on the path. Really,
yeah.
And the reason I love this program is the 44 Army Notre Dame program. The game is Army crushed Notre Dame 59-0 in this game.
Wow!
It actually rates as Notre Dame's worst loss in their entire program history, and. What's neat is 1944, the war was really at its height. And so you had service members who, diehard Army fans, diehard Notre Dame fans, they were listening all around the world to this game.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so impactful to the troops, and everyone listened to it so much that they would use this game as a way to test if soldiers were a spy. And so if they felt that, they weren't sure if you were a U.S. soldier or not, they would ask you to score the game. Because obviously, if you didn't know the score of the game, there's no way you were an American, you were a spy. I love that. I love that history. I love how that all ties together.
Maybe you're a hockey guy. Who knows? That's actually
and
funny.
No, so,
sure.
And then, my last piece, I picked it up about 2 weeks ago. It's really important. It's just great for me. My oldest son, I took him to his first baseball game about 3 weeks ago. It was Dodgers Cardinals, and he's seven. And it was very first Major League Baseball game, first time in a stadium of that size. I mean, just his watching his eyes the whole time. It was an incredible experience to share that with him and see how he's just loved it. He's asked me almost every day since when he can go back. So I have the
oh,
ticket
cool.
to program to that game, and just to keep that and give that to him at some point in the future when he kind of appreciates it.
Wow. Scotty, in your estimation, what is the most difficult item you ever collected for your collection?
I think you mentioned earlier, I have a solid run of Army Navy tickets, 1899 to present. I have them all PSA graded. I mean, I know you got
mm-hmm.
your critics, but for me, it's a way to preserve and showcase.
I grade most of my tickets. There's grading for grading, and then there's grading for protection and for provenance. I mean, I get a lot of my older tickets slabbed just to protect them from the elements. And so that, when I hand it to someone, we're like, what's this? It's easily identifiable. I mean,
yep.
I think Bob has an aversion to grading, because of the subjectiveness of it, not for provenance like this. So,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Story,
and I don't focus.
Storing my tickets in, sheets and top loaders and the like. But I'm pretty much aware of what the historical significance of my real early tickets from the 1900s,
mm-hmm.
late 1800s, that type of thing. So, but I also understand why people get greedy, because you do want to preserve them, so on and so forth. I just hope down the road that the encapsulation of the plastic or whatever doesn't have any impact on the ticket itself. As much as there's all guarantees that they won't, to me, I don't see how anything could be guaranteed like that. You know what I mean? But I do understand why people do it. Even though I dislike strongly graded items, especially the one thing that somebody asked me, do they grade programs? I said, why would you want to get a program graded? And you can never read it. It's so illogical to me. It's not even funny. But go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I couldn't see that. So, but if you look at my, if you would see the PSA series for Army Navy, you'd see, I have there's 1890, 1894 is missing. I those tickets may or may not even exist. I don't know. But I have a hole right there at 1919. And that ticket just eluded me for years and years and years. I never saw one. I never saw a picture of one. I never saw a reference to one to any obscure catalogs or auctions or anything. I just could not find it. And then actually not too long ago, about 4 or 5 months ago, there was a scrapbook sheet that hit eBay. It had 4 Army Navy tickets on it and some other items. And so I started really kind of examining it. I saw it had one 1920 stub, 2 1921 stubs, and then this other stub on there. And right next to the stub was a dinner menu. The cadets used to go to a dinner right before the game. Was a dinner menu to the 1919 game. And I said, oh, here it is. This is it. I found it. And I'm really studying the stub on the front. There's no dates. There's no identifications. It has the right look. It has the exact look of all the tickets do. It's got that Polo Grounds look to it. So I said, I got to take a chance. I may never see one again.
Yeah.
So I bought it. I was able to win it, and I got it in. I was really examining it. Couldn't find anything. I was thinking maybe it was faded. So I made a decision. I said, okay, I gotta soak these off. I can't not know. You know, maybe it's on the back, because they used to put the date on the back, kind of inscribed in that banknote style. And so I soaked the 20 and 21 off just to test the paper. It came off great, no problem. You know, that old water soluble glue. And I said, here we go. This is. I was really nervous, you know, whether I was going to damage it or what I was going to find. So I soaked off the ticket of the 1919. I cleaned it up, you know, it came off great. And I was looking, I was examining it, and it was all it has on the back is driving directions on how to get to the stadium. So I have this beautiful stub. I'm 99% sure it's from the 1919 game, and I have no way of proving it. And so the irony there for you, Bob, is I can't get it graded. It's got no identification marks. The PSA won't grade it without any kind of provenance.
Scotty, I found SGC to be pretty pretty cool about that stuff. I had a ticket, ditto, not a lot of markings on it. And I went through and did, I went through and did my homework. I found other, you know, other tickets that looked exactly like it that PSA had graded, et cetera. And I printed, I think I had like 6 pages of color printing, and then I hand wrote on there, you know, why I thought this was this ticket, and sent it to SGC, and they graded it. I know it's not your, but oftentimes I've found we know more about these, you know, esoteric sets than the people, than our slab masters do, you know. It's so.
Yeah, that's great. I need to check that out. I haven't heard about that, and I do want to try and get it, you know, at least protect it, as we said.
And, you know, that kind of bothers me about grading. So if there's nothing on the ticket, in theory, then the grader can't make a decision. Well, to me, at the same time, it doesn't really make sense that the you know, even if you do provide all the material to it, the grader still doesn't take your word for it that you've done all the research on it one way or the other. So that's an issue to me as far, or a thing I dislike about the grading. I do agree with what Joe is saying, though, that the SGC grading, they will, you know, if you do your homework, they will grade it type of thing. So, but I'll tell you, I would help you with your certification of it too, because I have never seen a 1919 ticket stuff myself. If you have that kind of providence to it, I don't see why they want to consider it. You know what I mean? A 1921, 20 and 21 looks like. So therefore, you know, it to me, it's still in the realm of what you actually have.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. If you send in those ticket stubs that they slabbed, yeah, you know more about this than they do. Sorry to get off topic there, but you know it. That I struggled with a ticket that I from 1913 or 14, I forget, that I was pretty sure Jim Thorpe had played in, and it took me a while to prove it, but I was able to get me to the point where I'm like, I'm 99% sure this is the ticket, you know, so yeah.
No, that's great. I appreciate that. I'll look into that. And then the only other one, the smaller item, I've had my eyes set on the, I don't know if you know the Bristow Adams posters. I love those early posters. And there's the West Point one with the, that leather helmet football player standing in front of the academy. So I've seen a couple at auction. I know there's one at the West Point Museum on display. I haven't seen any hit. So I've always had my eye out for that. That's kind of my attainable white whale that I've been looking for a few years.
Nice. So there's always stories that go along with this. I joke around about me running down an airport gangway to get Steve Largent's autograph, but the stories that go with this collecting are half the fun. It's kind of like you just talking about finding that ticket. I think you add a military mix to this, the Army Navy stuff that you're focusing on, and there's got to be some good stories for how you came across some of your items.
You kind of scour every aspect you can. You go to Bob mentioned the estate sales, you watch eBay, you watch the auctions, and I think a bulk of our stuff is found that way. Really what I love about it, is probably not how it's found, but the military connection. I had, you'll see it in the upcoming one, I had a full ticket to the 62 game that was preserved for the president's seats, and what I found was it was his military aide's ticket, and it came with photos, and I love kind of how the military is part of that sports history and tying into it, and I have a couple of early tickets that they believe was kind of part of Roosevelt's staff and military aide at the time. And so anytime the president goes to those tickets, he's got his military generals in tow. And, they're going to want to be where the commander in chief is. And so, that's not often they're going to get, tagged to say, hey, give me your tickets or I need to tear it. And so you kind of have these full tickets and these other items that have that military connection. So it's great. The other piece too is I run into players, throughout the Army, whether they're still in the Army or not. I'm like, oh man, I've seen you as a cadet in these programs. It's awesome to know some of these players now and see them, in my professional setting. But know they were on the field as a cadet as well.
That's gotta be cool for them too, to be like, you're kidding me. I've always thought it'd be interesting. If you're a player, if you're a professional player, you've probably seen just about everything out there. My wife's sister is married to an ex-professional baseball player, and I've asked him a few times, it's like, have you seen everything out there? And he's like, he goes, I've seen all my cards. Every once in a while, somebody will put something in front of me that I've never seen. He goes, that doesn't happen very often, but mostly it's magazines and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love it.
Scotty, I know you sell programs, football programs. Can you give us some background on our listeners, some information on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Joe, you mentioned earlier selling off your cards. I mean, it's kind of part our interests change, or we pick up lots.
Yeah.
We just need to fund our collections. And so I've kind of gotten into selling programs. I think they're awesome. There's enough demand for it. And a buddy of mine, his name's Jeff Garfunkel. He's over on the East Coast. I met him while I was at the Academy, and just one of the great people I've met through the hobby. He and I were presented an opportunity. We went in together, and we just recently purchased a collection of about 11,000 sports programs.
Wow.
They span from the 1930s to the 1990s. So no small undertaking there.
Hang on, Scotty. I've got to ask. Is that an institution who had 11,000 programs, or is that a collector? That is a hoard. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a collector.
Wow.
We actually bought it. I believe it was the collector that had passed away, and his family had no idea what to do with it, and so it was actually being sold to the family's lawyer. And we had happenstance to be nearby me here, and kind of found it through They were selling some of them on eBay. I reached out to them. They were selling an Army Notre Dame program, and I bought it and reached out to him, asked him if he had more, and he sent me this list of about 40 of them. And I said, man, this is – how do you – you know, what's going on? And just through that, we kind of found out he's got about, you know, over 10,000 available.
And isn't that exciting? There is a hobby story. It's like, you know, hey, do you got any more of these? Yeah, here's a list of 40. You're like, holy, oh, okay. And, you know, the butterflies in the stomach, like, what do I got here? I grabbed the tiger by the tail. I love that.
So it's great. It's basketball. It's college football. And, you know, so college and pro basketball, college football, pro football. Little bit of hockey and baseball, not very much. I mean, the guy was definitely a basketball, football guy. And just digging through it and listing, you know, we list through our eBay stores. I opened a new store. It's MVP Sports Auctions. My buddy Jeff, he lists through his store, mostly basketball. His
cool.
is Sports Mags, Sport Mags. And, you know, so it's great. We're putting up 20, 30 items a week, you know, just trying to dig through it, inventory it, and figure out what we have. But it's in some ways it's overwhelming when you're looking at, you know, 190 to 100 sorter boxes full of programs.
Yeah, no kidding. How do you pick those up, too? I mean, I talked earlier about how cumbersome, you know, uncut sheets are. I mean, I can't even imagine the magnitude of what 11,000 programs weigh, you know, how they smell.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a very loving and patient wife, especially in a job that moves me. Yeah, especially in a job that moves me every 3 years, as I think your last guest mentioned. So it's a game right now.
The most I ever bought at one time was helping somebody, just like you're saying. The collector passed away. The family didn't know what to do with the stuff. They had about 1,200 sport magazines, programs, all sports, and I bought them all. And it was, you know, I just asked them. They had them in totes with the plastic covers. I said, I'll pay extra for the totes. I can't repack all this stuff. I said, no.
No kidding.
Take everything. Just get it out of here, type of one. And
yeah.
that was a massive load. I distinctly remember that. That was a lot. But 11,000 is massive. It's huge.
How did you get
that's
those?
A lot of energy.
Logistically, because I've talked to a couple, like, you know, John Spano, you know, at BST, and he's like, oh, no, we rent a U-Haul and haul. I mean,
it's just,
sometimes it's how'd you pick that up, Scott? Now I'm just curious, logistic-wise, how the hell that happens.
Yeah, you know, I was lucky because the lawyer, the seller, was only about an hour and a half away from me, hour and a half. And so I've got three kids. I took the seats out of my Honda Odyssey and trucked over, you know, assessed it, and I think it ended up being two and a half trips. Back and forth. I was worried about the axles for a little while, but it held up great.
I bought 1988 football wax packs from a collector in Seattle once. I know, don't laugh. from a guy in Seattle. He posted up on his CU boards that he had like 200 boxes, you know, of uncut. I'm like, sure, meet me halfway. Meet me in Centralia, Washington, which is halfway between Portland and I took my Ford Bronco up there and I don't know what I thought. I obviously didn't think about it, but I had no idea how much that was, how much it weighed. He showed up with a trailer, flaps covered, and I'm putting this stuff, bucking seats down, and yeah, my car looked like a pregnant rat driving down the road. You know, the back end dragging. You know, you have no idea what that stuff weighs, or except I was naive about it. Yeah.
So just like the Steve Largent rookie card isn't founded on the East Coast. That's another reason why there's no 1988 Cubs wax boxes that can be found on the East Coast. Joe has them in Portland, Oregon. Scotty, we're almost out of time. Any other final thoughts that you could tell our listeners?
No, guys, thanks for having me on. It's, I really enjoyed the articles for the magazine. I encourage your readers to pick them up, just learn a little bit about the history and kind of how Army Navy scoped the football field, the changes, and even politically. And so it's a great series.
Yeah.
It's America's game, and I love it.
I will point out
too
that is on my bucket list. I need to get to see one game in person before I go, and I got to try to arrange it and as I get older, I keep saying to myself, I really got to get to one of these games. And I know it's a hot ticket, but hopefully I'll score one down the road and be in it.
Scotty, I've got to confess, earlier I said it was Navy 73, Army 20. I confess I embellished those numbers.
Yeah. No, I couldn't tell at all.
Okay.
Scotty, thank you for being on, and I look forward to the second part of the article, and I look forward to talking to you in the future. Thank you for being on.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Scotty.
Now, our goal line stance, we're down to 4 minutes. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. What did we learn on the show today?
I had an epiphany while Scotty was talking. He was talking about his dad and his grandfather who, when he went and visited them, he said going down, you know, into their collecting rooms was like a museum, and they talked about preserving history. I wasn't kidding when I said that. Gave me goosebumps because oftentimes us collectors don't tubes and boxes and you know, locked behind doors to protect them. And if you're not enjoying what you collect, then why are you collecting? You know, and that I have a pretty good display of my stuff. I have uncut sheets and ticket stubs, you know, from the first Seahawk win at my office. I do a pretty good job displaying my stuff, but I could definitely do better. And, you know, in one sentence, Scotty, you know, made me think about that, and I just need to do a better job of that.
Well, I think we all, especially true collectors, feel they are preserving history. And again, trying to display that history becomes very challenging. I know I have a lot of problems displaying just because of space constraints and, you know, how I store things and the like. And for me, one of my greatest enjoyments at night, some nights, is just to pull out a real old program and reread it and just reread the history again of the game and what happened in the game, the players and the like, so on and so forth. They're pulling out an old Street and Smith from the 40s, let's say, and just rereading the preseason picks and all that. I just find it fascinating because you're reading history all the time. And again, as we go paperless in 2017 more and more, it's going to be tough preserving that history because then we're going to have a cyber history, which I'm not all overly choked up about. But at the same time, the old paper is still, to me, very rare.
Without a doubt.
It's going to become, even more rare.
Well, look at Scotty here. Look at his collection. He is collecting the ticket stubs and his partner's collecting programs from every Army Navy game dating back, you know, time. He's got 99% of her, 90 whatever.
Correct.
I can't think of anybody else who puts that together. And once these sets are assembled, they are history. You know, he's made history.
Right.
I mean, I've mentioned before, and you know, that I'm trying to collect every program and every ticket stub of every college game Rhett Grange ever played. And I've got spreadsheets and checks and this and that. I mean, and that, you know, it's a weekly search on eBay, and every once in a while I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, when I thought I'd found one last week, you know, and I ran down to my collection and, oh no, God dang it. You know, it's probably been 6-8 months since I've checked the box, you know, on that spreadsheet.
Sure.
But once this is assembled, I mean, think about that. Once this is assembled, it's like every ticket stub from Army Navy, every ticket and program for every college game Rhett Grange played, home and away. I mean, these are, once they're assembled, they're pretty amazing pieces themselves.
Right. And it's an incredible collection you have there with Grange. I mean, that is, you know, a one-on-one as far as I'm concerned. It's not out there. It just does not exist. So, you know, you are preserving history, and I would say probably 99% of our readers and listeners are preserving history, and that's what it's all about. And to keep the word of the game alive, keep the men who played the game, their names alive, and respect what they did on the field. And especially Army-Navy is even more focused because, you know, many of these men gave their lives in service to our country, and we can't forget that. Joe, we're almost out of time, down to 30 seconds real quick. We're sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Again, check their website out, msbsportscards.com, and BST Auctions, their website, bstauctions.com. We'll be back with our second show toward the end of the month. Joe, thank you for being on. We had a great show today, very, very informative. Scotty was a great guest. It's just amazing. I'm just in awe of a collection like this. It's just incredible.
Yes.
And again, every time I say I've seen the best collection, I see an even better collection. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at the end of the month. GridironGreats Magazine.com. Thanks, Joe. We'll be talking.
Take it easy, Captain.